Post Reports is brought to you by Purina. You care about where your food comes from, whether it's for you or your pets. That's why Purina makes every ingredient count and is committed to responsible sourcing of ingredients. Learn more at purina.com/cares.
From the newsroom of the Washington Post.
Hey, it's Ross Helderman from the Post calling. How are you?
Hey there, it's Sungmin from the Post.
Hey, it's Dave Farron from the Post. Have you got a second?
This is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Thursday, July 30th. Today, the story of a police officer being asked to do his job differently, and how church choirs are weathering the pandemic.
It's the difference between power and influence. And probably 90% of what you need to do as a police officer involves power. Physical power, physical presence.
Earlier this summer, I went to Huntsville, Alabama to observe the police department giving officers mental health de-escalation training.
That's national reporter Hannah Dreyer. She spent a few days in Huntsville in June because the police department there was giving officers new training on how to handle mental health-related calls. And she wanted to see whether those officers were actually using that training once they get back to the field.
There's some things you do and you just take care of business. But in these special circumstances, these special populations, you learn that it's more important to have influence than power. And once you understand the power of influence, your idea of using force all the time will go way, way down.
So police departments across the country have been seeing more and more mental health calls as psychiatric services have been defunded across the country. And these calls are among the most likely to end in fatal shootings. Somewhere from a quarter to a half of all police shootings involve somebody in a mental health crisis. And that's especially true in Alabama. In Alabama, police have fatally shot 26 people who are in mental health crises in the last 5 years. And four of those shootings have happened in Huntsville, Alabama. And so in an attempt to reduce those shootings and make mental health calls safer, the police department has rolled out this training to try to encourage officers to take mental health calls more seriously and approach them in a more empathetic, de-escalating way.
When I addressed the feelings, I told him that I validated how he felt. If you don't do them two things, you cannot set up rapport. Once you get rapport, you'll have influence, then you can get behavior change. So that's what we're going to go for. But the whole thing about this is, how do we listen?
So then in Huntsville, why are they investing all this money in training police to do this rather than giving this money to, like, social workers or other people who would be able to respond to these calls?
A lot of this really comes down to money. So in Huntsville, the city allocates $51 million a year for the police department and less than $1 million a year for behavioral health services. And the response in Huntsville and all across the country has been to try to train police to do these social work jobs in addition to their other responsibilities, because it's just much cheaper than hiring a bunch of new people who will focus only on mental health calls. And that's been true in major police departments and also at the national level. In June, Trump signed an executive order on police reform, and he said, we're not going to defund police, we're going to go the opposite direction, and we're going to train police so that they're perfectly trained. And this sort of mental health de-escalation training is really at the heart of Trump's executive order.
So what does this training actually look like?
Today's class is, how do you listen? It ain't about how you talk, it's how you listen.
The training is all about trying to teach officers not to use force and to go more slowly when they're dealing with somebody in a mental health crisis. So I showed up to this training and the officers looked like they were in detention. They were like slumped over on tables. They were already asking if they could be dismissed early. And the trainer said that he understood that he felt like that when he had to go to these trainings himself as a patrol officer. And it had taken him being a crisis negotiator to learn that what you say to people in a crisis really can make a difference.
The biggest problem you have with police officers, we're so used to going to a place telling everybody what to do. So doing that, you never have the opportunity to listen.
And so the training teaches officers about the different kinds of mental health crises, like somebody could be manic, somebody could be suicidal. And then it just tries to walk them through how to be a good listener. So a lot of it is just sort of teaching them how to ask questions and how to stand in an open, inviting posture.
Giving up a little bit of control gives you actually greater control. If I read, I'm getting too close, he ain't liking it. By me backing up, hey man, what about just up back here? Did I not just give him a little bit of control right there?
Like the trainer kept telling the officers to put their hands by their heart to indicate that they were sincere. And the officers would say, well, we want our hands by our guns.
Feels like a good symbol for the crux of this problem.
Yeah. I mean, basically the officers feel like they have to be out there super defensive, trying to protect themselves, trying to protect other people from somebody who could be in a crisis and could be violent. And the trainers are trying to convince them that it can be both safe and effective to do a different kind of policing.
So where's the argument is now?
Well, the only way you can demand an ID is if they are suspected of committing a crime.
Okay, so if somebody runs and you don't know no crime, why chase after them? I don't, because I'm fat, short, can't run good.
A lot of that is... We got personal fast in here, I'm saying. A lot of that is dependent on the call service, the environment, and a lot of your extenuating circumstances.
One moment that stood out to me from the training was a morning that the trainer was trying to explain to the officers that sometimes it makes sense to let a person in a mental health crisis run. So usually if a police officer sees somebody running from them, they're going to give chase because the assumption is maybe that person committed a crime.
Even though maybe they're just scared, which is like an intuitive human response.
Right. There's a million reasons somebody could run. And if you're having a paranoid episode, there's, you know, a million more reasons that you might run. And so the trainer was saying, just consider sometimes you don't have to give chase. You can go find that person later. And one of the sergeants in this class got really angry and he started shouting.
That's also why they became cops, Lonnie.
He said, that's why we became cops. That's why we all became cops. He was banging the table.
Well, I don't want to take the instinct out of the
15, 16 years old.
I get it.
And one of his seatmates sort of patted him on the shoulder and said, okay, we get it. You're aggressive. But the police, I think, really took this as sort of an affront to what they see as their core mission, which is maintaining law and order.
And what did you make of that moment?
It just seems like so challenging to try to be reshaping police to do this other kind of work. I mean, police officers are trained to deploy force. In this town in Huntsville, police officers get hundreds of hours of training in how to use their firearms, and hundreds of hours more in how to fight on the ground, how to put people into headlocks. And then you're giving them 16 hours of training in how to not use force. And their response was, we're cops. People have to follow our commands. That's what all of their training is telling them.
So tell me about what happened after the training finished.
I rode around with one of the officers who was in this training, an officer called Thomas Parker.
Yeah. Smart. Well, it would have been smarter just to do it at the taillight. Because I knew that would have definitely shattered.
Yeah.
But I just...
Yeah, hard to shatter a windshield.
Tried. Failed.
Well, it sounds like it worked.
My rookie was just like...
I know, it's like movie stuff.
He's like, He just stood there. I was like, go, go, go.
Officer Parker has been in the police force for 10 years. Before that, he was a Marine. And he is a very proactive police officer. The department said he's one of the best they have. And what he loves is felony arrests. So he pulls people over, but rarely gives them tickets. He tries not to do minor drug busts. He doesn't care about that sort of smaller stuff. He wants to put people in prison for burglary, for shootings, for what he thinks of as like serious police work. He is 6'5". He's got a buzz cut.
6'5".
He's a very imposing presence, and he works out a lot to try to be more imposing out there. He thinks that it's safer for everyone if he looks like tough. So he can bench press 300 pounds. He's got he chews tobacco all day. He has a bulletproof vest and stands up very straight, even if it's pouring rain. And, you know, he's just trying to project force because that's what he's been taught.
Is he from Huntsville originally?
He's from Huntsville. Huntsville is a segregated town where the south part of the town is pretty wealthy, very white, and the north part is poorer and is mostly Black people. So Parker grew up in the south. He had never really gone to the north until he became a police officer there. But he requested to be a police officer in the north because he saw it as this really action-packed place with a lot of potential to make felony arrests. He goes out and he responds to calls all day long with other white cops. The residents are almost always Black. And he says he's just sort of gotten used to this low-level tension and people saying, you guys kill Black people saying they don't trust him.
So you've chosen North, like, all through.
Mm-hmm.
Is it ever strange being a white officer with, like, all the calls we've gone out to from Black people?
Not strange at all. It's just, I mean, everybody, they're all people,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Do you think it comes into it? Like, do the people who you go out
the
to?
The race? I mean, you see, I mean, I cannot tell you how many times a Black person has called me the N-word.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many times I've arrested a white person and they have said, y'all shoot Black people.
Really?
Or you're only doing this to me because I'm Black. I mean... And I'm just like, what you're trying to get me to say or mm-hmm. or anything like that? And I'm just like, just shut up. And I close the door. I don't really think anything about it. It is what it is.
Do you think
they're all people? Everybody has problems. It's just the problems over here are more intense than the problems down south. That's what it boils down to. And 9 times out of 10, a problem over here is going to end up involving a gun.
So what was it like doing this ride along with him?
He got several mental health calls every day that I was with him. And on one of the calls, he responded to a man who said that his wife was schizophrenic bipolar and needed to go to the mental health hospital.
So it probably didn't even record it.
Or it's
still in here.
What we're hearing now is audio from Officer Parker's body camera.
Yes! Oh my God, you found it. This is it.
Yep.
Okay, so you go in the house.
And so Parker had just gotten this training that was all about how to de-escalate and how to talk to somebody who was manic. And he showed up at this call, and this man's wife was pacing and sort of ranting about devils and threats to her family. And the man said, look, she's not right. You got to take her. And Parker decided that the woman was pretending to be mentally ill. And he left. So he was on the scene for about 7 minutes. And then he decided she's faking. And he went on to get lunch.
But didn't her husband actually say, like, my wife has a history of mental illness?
Yeah, so the husband said has schizophrenia, she is bipolar, she's having an episode. But Parker was really looking for whether she was breaking the law. And he decided, you know, ranting and antagonizing your husband, none of that's illegal. And it's hard to get somebody involuntarily committed.
I would That's what I'm saying. Those moments when she is right is when, hey, just sit her down and say, hey, let's get you that help and go to the wellstone.
He would have had to make a case that she was a danger to herself or others. And then he would have had to get her into an ambulance that day. And he decided this isn't a police matter. And what he said on the way back from that call was, this husband's trying to make this my problem. And why would I make your problem my problem if it's not breaking the law?
You just don't attack me. We've got a female on the line now.
And then the next day,
calling from the same number saying help her, but she's not giving any further information.
He got called back to that same apartment.
Help. I'm going over there.
You think it's just going to be that same couple?
It is that same couple. I know it's what it is. I really didn't want to deal with them.
And this time, the woman was threatening her neighbors with a gun and a butcher's knife. And so that was much different. And he immediately focused. He sort of went into cop mode. He went into her apartment where she had this gun, and he was like looking all around the apartment for the gun. He was working with another officer to get her out of the apartment, to get her away from the weapon. And, you know, it was really tense. And in the end, they were able to de-escalate that and get her into an ambulance and get her committed. But the husband was furious. The husband was like, you were here yesterday. You totally blew me off. Now you're back. And the situation's much worse. Now the woman has a gun charge. Child Protective Services are going to be looking at her kids. And it could have been even worse. So the husband was like, why didn't you take her yesterday? And Parker's response was, well, yesterday she hadn't broken the law yet.
I told you, Mr. Parker, I said, can you take her to the institution or something?
No, but she was not a danger to herself or others. Walking around going, was not a danger.
But I know already it's been going like this for 2 weeks, Mr. Parker.
What about the girl?
I don't know where she got that. Y'all know where she put it.
What did the officer say about that afterward?
So afterward, I mean, right afterward, Parker sort of had this surge of adrenaline and he was laughing sort of uncontrollably with another officer.
She called me the N-word 100 times. You can't just be done when somebody calls.
And talking about how they thought they were maybe going to have to shoot this woman.
Dude, I really envisioned her grabbing a gun, and I really did. And we were gonna.
In that room?
I was like, I was like, we're gonna smoke this woman. I was like, it's gonna happen. That's why I was telling Rashawn, go look at that apartment, see if you see the goddamn gun. All right? I was like, this is what it's come down to.
As soon as we walked in there, I did this to make sure my light was on, because I saw going south.
Oh, I did too, dude. I was like, well.
But then a couple days later, Parker was still talking about this call with some of the other officers in the precinct. And he was just saying that he didn't know what saved it from going that badly. And it felt to him like they just sort of got lucky, like the woman calmed down, there was a big rainstorm that maybe helped. And she ended up going peacefully. They never found the gun. And this other officer was saying to Parker, like, yeah, it's totally unfair because if you mess up, you're going to be blamed, but we're not specialists.
When he was thinking back on what happened there and how close he got to potentially killing this woman, did he think about it in relation to the training?
So when I asked Parker about this, he said that he was just going on instinct. He totally fell back to what he knew. It was such a high pressure situation that he didn't think about the training at all.
Did you think about doing, like, the Johnny, like, hands like steepled over your heart thing when you were in that?
I never thought about doing any of that.
Okay, how come?
I just went right back to what I normally do.
It's like instinct?
Yes.
But he did do some of the techniques from the training. So he held his hand by his heart. He used this woman's first name. He tried repeating back some of the things that she was saying to her. Like she was saying, I had this gun. It was just to protect myself. I didn't mean to hurt anyone. And he was saying, yeah, I know you didn't mean to hurt anyone.
What did the gun
take? A gun?
Okay, where did the gun go?
I don't know. So I had it to protect me because they're all sides to me. I'm not going to lie. Okay. But
I didn't about that.
Yes, sir. Yeah. I did not want to hurt anybody.
I know, but you
I just want to keep. No, they keep running up on me. And there's cases on them already. Don't make me a liar if you want to try to make a case. Can you get out of my house if you want to try to make a case? I want my child back. He's the protection.
We're just trying to make sure you're
so sort of maybe just by instinct or by what he's learned on the job, he was doing some de-escalation tactics. But in the end, those don't seem to be what helped. He tried to talk this woman down and convince her to leave her apartment, but she was just getting more hysterical. And so he ended up just sort of using his body to force her out of the apartment. And his conclusion was that training is not helpful in a situation that could be life or death. But then he also didn't think the training was useful when the woman was just ranting and pacing, because he didn't think that was a police matter. So it's just a huge amount of resistance.
Like that there is a fundamental sense that this, we just don't want this to be our job. Like responding to these kinds of situations is just not something that we are fundamentally that interested in doing.
Right. Like every time Parker got a mental health call, he's groaning. He would dawdle going over there. He would say, okay, this is going to be really quick. I'm going to get right back to doing real police work. And when he started, these calls weren't a part of the job. It was really just arresting people and doing drug busts and criminal charges. So the job is changing and he can't resist it totally, but it's definitely not something that he's trying to do more of.
Why is it that you're taking me, who, you know, let's just be honest here, not everybody with the highest education becomes police officers.
Yeah.
So you're taking me and you're trusting me to make a medical decision based off of a few minutes with this person?
Yeah.
No. If anything, hey, they go there and they need to be properly examined by the right person with the correct education.
Right.
Not some third shift officer.
What does Parker think should happen? Like, what does he think is the solution for this?
So Parker and, you know, a lot of experts who study this would like to see specialized units going out to mental health calls. So some cities are having success with these sort of mobile response units where social workers or specially trained mental health workers go out and check up on people who seem to be in mental health crises. So that would be like the call that Parker got on this first day when this woman was just ranting and pacing and her husband was worried about her. For Parker, that was totally uninteresting and not a police matter. But if you were a social worker or a mental health worker, that would be exactly what your job is, trying to connect people in mental health crises to services. So the police would love it if somebody else would take these calls and they wouldn't have to worry about messing them up or dealing with them. The problem, of course, is that takes money. And right now, the money is all going to training.
Hmm. Well, that's what seems so ironic about the situation is that, you know, there are obviously a lot of conversations around this idea of defunding the police or taking money that is being given to the police and putting it elsewhere. And people view that as being anti-police. But it seems like what Parker wants and what a lot of police officers want is exactly what defunding the police calls for, like giving money to other people to help deal with these problems that police are ill-equipped to respond to and also seem like they don't even like responding to.
I think that's exactly right. This is where Black Lives Matter and the anti-racism movement and Blue Lives Matter and police officers probably agree. One of the officers that Parker was talking to put it this way. He said, I'm a meathead. They put things on us that shouldn't be related to law enforcement. And then when you screw up because you're not a specialist, you're held accountable.
You know, it's interesting that you say that these police officers are saying that it is not their job to deal with these mental health calls and that, you know, they're about kind of serious crime and serious arrests and not just people having mental health crises. Because I kind of feel like in the year 2020, like dealing with mental health calls, that is part of your job. Like a big part of policing is not just making like high level crime busts, but about interacting with the community and being a part of that community. And you can't just write that off as not your job.
I mean, what I saw these officers wrestling with was when they joined the police department, they were signing up, they thought, for a different kind of job. And they feel like now, yeah, in 2020, being a police officer is a totally different role, but it's not the role that they feel like they signed up for. And from what I saw, sometimes they feel bad about the way that these calls go. I mean, in the case that I was talking about, this woman was having a mental health crisis, and now she has a criminal charge. Her children are maybe going to be put into foster care. She had this traumatic incident where she was sort of forced into an ambulance. And the officers don't feel good about that. But they also feel like they're so out of their depth. Like they don't know how to deal with somebody who's in that situation. And so they feel like it should really be up to somebody who's had a lot more training and specialization.
Hannah Dreyer is a national reporter for The Post. And now, one more thing about how church choirs are surviving the pandemic.
I'm Michelle Borstein. I'm one of the religion reporters at The Washington Post.
Okay.
Now you're taping on your end, right?
Okay. On my phone, yes.
At St. Joseph's in Old Town Alexandria, Cali is in the gospel choir and also in the women's choir there.
I'm a soprano, so I want to hear my altos. I want to hear the tenors and the bass. I want to hear Mr. CJ playing his guitar, Mr. Hopper playing the piano. I want to hear all that. It helps me, it motivates me, and it moves me.
She's always been big into singing. Like, she'll just start singing at any moment when you're talking to her.
Songs that the congregation like is, God is the joy and the strength of my life.
Obviously, everybody knows what it's like to connect with other people and get, like, a high from singing with other people. But Callie described what a lot of people have described to me, which is that singing together is a kind of calling for them.
You're touching somebody.
They see themselves as basically uplifting other people in the same way that a pastor preaching is, like conduits of the Holy Spirit.
And every time somebody says, oh, you touched me, then I'm fine. Then I've done what God has asked me to do.
Choirs really stand out. I talked to some scientists who said that it's sort of like standing in a room and just 100 people coughing at each other for an hour. So churches have been, you know, hot spots all around the country.
We sang on the 16th of March, which was the third Sunday in March. That's when everything shut down. No rehearsal, no choir, no gathering, no fellowship. You know, we really, really, really got distant.
And choirs have also not been able to meet virtually, which a lot of us do stuff virtually, because there's a time lag on Zoom. And so you can't really sing together on Zoom. So basically, they have not sung with another person since March.
Grant this in all our prayers to your son.
Where I am right now, I am in my dining room. I'm in church. I'm in my church, as I call it. I have my hymn book and my missalette, which has all the Bible verses or whatever the readings are.
Plenty good room, plenty good room.
I will follow and sing whatever it is they're singing. And I just sit here by myself and do that.
Plenty good room, plenty good room, just choose your seat and sit down.
Some churches, you know, they can solicit video or audio from people that you make at your house and then turn it into like a cool Zoom-looking Brady Bunch kind of thing. And then there's just been a lot of people who have tried to go to small groups, you know, family singing.
A mighty fortress is our God.
Or porch choirs, which is, you know, what it sounds like, where you're just singing together with a small group outside. And then they try, you know, some things where they'll have like, a call and response, which anyone in Catholic Church is familiar with, or someone's singing and then someone's responding. So they'll have everybody mute themselves, and then people, there can be a leader, and then people can take turns responding.
Tell me, what do you see? Tell me, what do you see?
There's a lot of beautiful things online, but it's usually, you know, the much more highly produced stuff, not something at an average church like Callie's. We've had, this is an ongoing issue in churches, which is that they've become in the last, especially evangelical churches in recent decades, you know, basically performances. And some clerics I talked to said, like, they're kind of praying for you. I mean, that's really not, you're supposed to be the one that's connecting. And we've kind of turned that over to entertainers, and that maybe worship has become too entertainment focused and not enough on the experience of the person. But I think for people who love singing, and especially choirs, it's a loss.
I still do it by myself, but I sure love singing with my choirs.
She doesn't feel that she's serving other people, which is how she sees her music.
And so when I'm singing here by myself, I don't have anybody to sing to. My family probably sick of hearing me, but, you know. So, but sometime I'll just go in the other room and just get one of my tracks to a song and just go start singing.
That's why I am not ashamed of the gospel.
Singing is like another language of how you're talking to each other and bringing each other up and sharing these songs, that whatever song you sing with people that runs through your life. That's what these hymns are, and that's what these gospel songs are. People are in tears when they sing them. You know, there's a lot of, obviously, in every facet of society, but there's a lot of anxiety about what's going to happen to religious institutions because of the virus. And I think it's just adds to the anxiety, like what's going to happen to churches and small churches. And, you know, when will they be together again?
Michelle Borstein is a religion reporter for The Post. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. You may have seen that earlier today, President Trump tweeted about the possibility of delaying the election. And we were wondering, can he actually do that? Well, there is, in fact, an episode of our politics podcast, Can He Do That?, that addresses that exact question.
To change the date of the election would definitely take a new act of Congress, and it would have to apply both to congressional elections and the presidential election.
You can find a link to that episode of Can He Do That? In our show notes and at postreports.com. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.